Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Cosmos Magazine Summer 2018, probably episode 6. I'm doing cardiac rehab, trying to actually read and get the actual process through, with the actual reading up to 40 minutes and beyond. And imagine, amazingly, it's really wearing me out trying to read and go through all like this. But this article by Diani Lewis is Bring Back That Loving Feeling. Psychedelic drugs have long been outlawed. Now psychiatrists want to bring them back. Diani Lewis reports. On a sweltering New York evening in August 2016, Jesse Noakes finally found relief from years of mind-numbing depression. As he sat on a sofa facing a therapist, his gloom melted away, replaced by a feeling of clarity, warmth, and enthusiasm. It was magical, he says, something that I was so, so desperate for. The Australian writer had spent his 20s cycling from one antidepressant to the next without relief. The therapy session that finally sliced through the mental miasma came at the end of months-long global quest, which took him to the Netherlands, Switzerland, and then finally the US. It took him to the wrong side of the law. It was because the therapy session was boosted by a dose of MDMA, an active ingredient of an illegal drug called ecstasy. Clandestine therapy sessions like these may soon be a thing of the past. For years now, a band of dedicated scientists have been quietly building a case to redeem the reputation of MDMA. A raft of other psychedelic drugs, LSD, psychophyllum, mescaline, ketamine, and hoping to deliver items into the hands of mainstream psychiatry. These are all drugs I'll have to get molecular tours of. They claim that when it comes to some of our most debilitating mental illnesses, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, addiction, obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, therapeutic cupboard is close to bare. Psychedelic drugs may provide a radical new answer. Efforts of the psychedelic champions are paying off. In August 2014, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, gave a green light to a phase 3 clinical trial of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for treating PTSD. It is also designated MDMA a, quote, breakthrough therapy, clearing the path for a speedy approval process. If successful, it will be the first psychedelic to be approved since the clampdown on mind-bending drugs swept the world in the early 70s. Psychedelics weren't always on the wrong side of the law. In the 50s, dozens of Hollywood stars, including Esther Williams and Cary Grant, were taking LSD as part of their psychotherapy regime, or DM. Lysergic acid diethylamine, a derivative of lysergic acid from the ergot fungus, had been first synthesized in the late 30s by Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann, working for the pharmaceutical company Sandoz. He discovered the mind-bending properties in 43 while making a batch. He must have touched his face, his lips or eyes, and perhaps inadvertently absorbed some. The accidental dose brought on a dreamlike state, during which he experienced an uninterrupted stream of fantastic pictures, extraordinary shapes with intense kaleidoscopic play of colours. As he glided back to reality, he knew he had stumbled upon a potent psychoactive drug. By the end of the 40s, LSD was being sold under the trade name Diacetyl to relieve anxiety of obsessive neurosis, in conjunction with psychotherapy. There was significant scientific interest in LSD and other psychedelics throughout the 50s and 60s. At Harvard University, however, that interest got out of hand. More than just academic curiosity drove psychologists Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert to want to research psilocybin, the LSD, and mescaline. They took the drugs themselves, distributed them to others. By 64, both had been dismissed. We continued ad hoc experiments and were wild parties that were any form of rigorous scientific inquiry without any form. That were more wild parties than any form of rigorous scientific inquiries. As psychedelics became inextricably linked with the 60s, counterculture governments cracked down. In the US, President Richard Nixon branded Leary the, quote, most dangerous man in America. The US Congress passed the Controlled Substances Act in the 70s. A year later came the United Nations Convention on Psychedelic Substances, which bound signatories to follow its prescriptions. LSD, psilocybin, and mescaline, among others, were put on its Schedule 1 heritage drugs, deemed to have no therapeutic value. Research on most psychedelic drugs ground to a halt. MDMA, that's 3,4-methylethylenedioxymethametaphetamine. In fact, I can possibly imagine that, but just by reading that name. See how I go. I'll go on a molecular tour of MDMA later on. How about that, guys? Was added to Convention Schedule 1 in 1986. Oh, dear. First patented in 1913 by a German chemical company, Merck, for potential to staunch internal bleeding. It never ended up being tested on humans and was largely forgotten until rediscovered in 65 by a chemist at the Dow Chemical Company. It gained a small following amongst psychiatrists as a psychotherapeutic aid in the 70s and the early 80s until governments around the world banned it in line with Schedule 1 listing. But not everyone gave up. On psychedelic psychiatrists who had experienced the drug for themselves or read a smattering of pre-prohibition reports of their use were left wondering whether a potentially beneficial therapy had been shelved for particular reasons. Michael Mithoffer, in particular, was intrigued by the possibility that MDMA offered something new for the burgeoning and largely intractable problem of PTSD. Quote, I really felt strongly we needed to do careful research, said the Charleston, South Carolina-based psychiatrist. In the late 90s, he turned to the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies for advice. MAPS. That's interesting. Found by the American psychologist Eric Dublin in 86. As it was one of the number of philanthropic organizations that cropped up in the wake of the global countdown. Their mission was to re-educate a suspicious public and to lobby for carefully controlled research into psychedelics. Mithoffer was convinced that he would have to conduct his MDMA study outside the US. But MAPS got behind the project, sourcing funding and helping develop a hefty 500-page protocol that was submitted to the FDA in late 2001. With almost no pushback, the trial was approved a month later. Academia was not so welcoming. Not a single institution was game enough to be associated with the groundbreaking trial. Delays came from the Drug Enforcement Agency. It took 2.5 years and the intervention of the U.S. Senator on Mithoffer's behalf before DA issued a license to trial the drug. Now, that's very interesting. And there is, strong scientific precedence for innovators and scientists who are falling afoul of institutions to get political support. That's an interesting aspect. It's something you read over and over again. The study was small, just 20 survivors of childhood sexual abuse and rape. But the results were encouraging. Of the 12 people who underwent MDMA-assisted psychotherapy sessions, 10 showed improvements. Okay, so this controlled trials, I suppose, compared with only 2 out of the 8 in the placebo group. Mithoffer and his colleagues have since completed the study of 24 Army veterans, firefighters and police officers. They found positive enduring effects in both trials. A phase 3 trial was set to start in 2018 and will enroll a large number of people and institutions across the US, Canada and Israel. MAPS has fielded more than 20,000 requests from patients wishing to participate in the trial, and more than 4,000 psychiatrists have been clamoring to get a spot on a training course in how to conduct MDMA therapy. Quote, "It's quite striking how much interest there is," Mithoffer says. When Swiss psychiatrist Peter Ogden got wind of Mithoffer's first MDMA trial, he and his wife, psychotherapist Vienna Wildmer, jumped on the plane to the US. The aim was to convince the MAPS to collaborate with a small trial in Switzerland. Meanwhile, Ochsen's colleague Peter Gasser was eager to conduct more research into LSD-assisted psychotherapy. Both had trained during the brief window of permissiveness in Switzerland starting in the late 80s. But in 93, a patient with an undiagnosed heart condition took a psychedelic drug, ibogaine, and died. Switzerland fell into a line with other countries. So things endured for 13 years until 2006. Switzerland celebrated the centenary, Velvet Hoffman's birth. Gasser saw the opportunity to push for a resurrection of LSD research. With the MAPS backing, the Swiss government gave permission for a small trial of LSD-assisted therapy to treat people under terminal cancer. Oh, and the pilot study of MDMA was also approved. Today, Olin and Gasser shared the distinction of holding the world's only two licenses to treat people with LSD and MSDCA outside the formal clinical trial. Only Swiss patients are eligible, ruling out someone like Noakes, with only the hardest cases to qualify. People with heart conditions and risks of psychosis are barred. Mild altering is an apt description for psychedelic drugs. While antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs need to be taken continuously for months or years, studies suggest in some cases just one or two trips of psychedelic in conjunction with psychotherapy sessions can be enough. Though two or three sessions a year are more typical, psychedelics enrich and deepen the therapy process, Gesser says. MDMA is not a so-called classical psychedelic. Unlike LSD or psilocybin, it doesn't cause beautiful pictures here. Hallucinations. It's often referred to in medical literature as an empathogen due to its ability to induce a feeling of empathy and compassion, including self-compassion. Brain imaging studies show MDMA decreases the activities of the brain's emotion center, the amygdala, however, wherever that is. However, at the same time, it increases activities in the higher processing region of the prefrontal cortex. This dialing down the emotional input while ramping up the activity of the reasoning center may explain the therapeutic effects for PTSD, where patients simply cannot forget their emotional trauma. For Mithoffer, this jives with what he sees in his patients. Jives, okay. Quote, "If you can decrease the fear and bring on higher processing, you can try to get a new perspective on the process, the trauma, in a different way," as he said. It also jibes with Noakes' experience on Sweltering New York evening in 2016. He calls how MDMA cut through an emotional haze, giving him the sense of clarity about his turmoil. "If for a few hours you can turn off the fear completely, it seems to be what MDMA can offer. In the right environment, the picture becomes into focus and you can go, oh, that's what's going on, time to make some changes," he says. He described it like opening a window into his mind. Quote, "MDMA session shows you what it's like when you're relaxed, confident and open," he says. "It shows you that you're able to process very difficult things, confront things you thought were terrible to confront. MDMA's ability to strengthen a person's sense of connection to others is also crucial," Owen says. Quote, "It helps get people in touch with other people again, especially for victims of interpersonal trauma." The brain scans give us some idea how MDMA achieves the far-reaching effects, pinning down the molecular mechanisms of imagination. This is amazing. Science is really getting in. MDMA creates a minor snowstorm in the brain, showering it with serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, a chemical known as neurotransmitters because they carry signals from neurons to neurons. Commonly prescribed antidepressants also raise the levels of neurotransmitters, but MDMA also causes the release of stress hormones like cortisoids, as well as oxytocin associated with social bonding. For some researchers, this snowstorm of brain chemicals raises a red flag. Quote, MDMA is a very messy drug, says Luke Dray, a drug and alcohol researcher at Swinburne University in Melbourne. He described the evidence for MDMA trials as less than compelling and says proponents are ignoring the negative consequences of taking MDMA. Studies of long-term users of ecstasy, for instance, have shown problems with memory, reduced serotonin levels, and neuron damage. Quote, utilizing a drug with the known negative effects does outweigh the benefit, he says. Mintoffer concedes, like many drugs, MDMA has risks, but long-term use is not what psychedelics advocates propose. When it comes to LSD and other classical psychedelics, the clinical story is similar. Gets a studying of LSD-assisted psychotherapy for people with end-of-life anxiety, LGO, found that LSD reduced anxiety in 12 participants with the effects lasting for years. Studies using milder psychedelics, psilocybin, have been even more promising. In 2016, two studies with the combined 80 participants found that anxiety and depression were alleviated and attitude towards death improved. Oh dear. I'm assuming I had a strange attitude towards death. I sort of had it. Yeah. For 60 to 80% of the people who took the drug, the positive effect was felt 6 months later. The specifics, I mean, it's hard to say. In any case, I probably would not have benefited from being treated at all because I got better. So there you go. The specifics of how psychedelics produce their therapeutic benefits or how they cause hallucinations are not fully understood. Compared with MDMA, the effect on the brains are less scattergun. They activate single neurotocin, serotonin 5-HT2A receptor that studs neurons found in the brain's outer layer or cortex. Brain imaging shows that psychedelics literally, quote, expand the mind, says pharmacologist David Nichols at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. In 2016, a study from the Imperial College of London and the Berkeley Foundation in Oxford, which funds psychedelic research, used MRI scans to show a dramatic increase in connectivity, different brain regions in subjects, say, LSD. This increased the connectivity and particularly evidence in the visual cortex, which may explain hallucinations. Normally, neurons fire and communicate with other cells with their logical neighborhood and rarely reach out to communicate with distant parts of the brain. When you take a psychedelic, Nichols says, all the internal structures and local networks seem to break down and they all reach out to everything that starts globally connecting. For Gasser, the mind-expanding effect of a classical psychedelics underpins their therapeutic effect. It's not what kind of Alice in Wonderland, it's not a kind of Alice in Wonderland fantasy land. He says, Sheridan's can be changing and challenging, but his patients' problems come to the surface in the LSD sessions. The drug, he explains, brings about a feeling of connectedness to nature, to friends, to loved ones. Deep-seated issues remain buried during the hustle and bustle of everyday life. MAPS goal is to have MDA reclassified as a pharmaceutical drug by 2021. And a phenicillin close on its heels. If the legal landscape of the US changes, other countries may follow. For Jesse Noakes, the mainstream acceptance of psychedelics can't come soon enough. Having now found a trusted therapist in Australia, his therapy no longer requires repeating to the other side of the world, although it still takes him to the wrong side of the law. But his confidence, that's beautifully put there. Isn't that beautifully put together? The wrong side of the world, but wrong side of the world. So I love these two conceptual areas just put together. But he's confident that the psychedelic tide is turning. Quote, I think it's inevitable, he says. Now, we're going to go back and read some. I now know to read the boxes afterwards, not in the middle, because it really destroys the reading quote. Now, this box here called Antipodes Antithepy, a Missed Opportunity. In Australia, attempts to establish a trial of MDMA has proven difficult. Sandy Fairline of the PS, TSD researcher at the University of Adelaide reflects a cautious mood. It's important not to get overly excited, he says. It has to be 95% science, 5% hope, and I think the moment the reality, really it's a little too early. But for addiction psychologist Stephen Bright, this is a missed opportunity. He's the vice president of PRISM, Psychedelic Research into Science and Medicine, set up in 2011 to mirror the work of MAPS in the US. In psychiatry, there hasn't been a revolutionary drug since Prozac come out, he says, in the mid, and that was in the 90s. Melbourne-based psychiatrist Nigel Strauss has been agitating for research on MDA and psychedelics. There's an element of new paradigm with these drugs, and it's exciting, he says. In 20, that sounds weird. That sounds so. It's a new paradigm. It just really reeks of, oh my god. Well, if it is a new paradigm, it's something that you almost don't get told about. I don't. Okay. In 2015, he and his and others put together a proposal to study MDA to treat PTSD at the University of Melbourne. The night before it was due to be reviewed by the Ethics Committee, the university's Vice Chancellor into Research deemed the study too controversial. Gee, that's not really funny. After that, Strauss says, a lot of discussions around town and realised that pretty much every university was going to adopt that attitude. Strauss now focuses his effort on educating people about the research that's happening elsewhere, hoping that the designated drugs, destigmatising the drugs, clear the path for research in future. Such resistance perplexes Mitt Hover, that's the US guy. We're not saying this is the best thing since sliced bread, he says. We're saying we should do careful research. Quote, the fact there's resistance to doing careful research is disturbing because we're talking about finding a better treatments for people who are committing suicide, and that's not a trivial matter. I would agree with that type of stuff. I think that's a beautiful thing that person said. He's refocused it. You know, that's a good thing. Ketamine's special legal loophole. Unlike LSD or MDMA, the hallucinogenic ketamine, aka party drug Special K, I've never heard of that one, is already a recognized pharmaceutical. It has been in use as an anesthetic as well as an animal tranquilizer since the 60s. It works primarily by blocking the receptor for the neurotransmitter glutamine in the nerve cells, but its interaction with numerous other brain cells receptors makes it hard to know which activities are responsible for the effects. Now I have to do, there's so many molecules, I might do glutamine again. I sort of can almost remember glutamate. When I say do glutamate, that's, so glutamate, that's right, that glutamate is a transmitter. I have to remember what that is. Because it is a controlled but not illegal drug, the doctors are able to prescribe ketamine off-label to treat conditions for which it hasn't officially been approved, such as chronic pain, depression, alcohol addiction, and OCD. The drug is usually given intravenously and not necessarily paired with psychotherapy, according to Colleen Liu, a clinical psychologist responsible for the first randomized controlled trials of ketamine in Australia. Liu, who works at the University of New South Wales, was initially sceptical about ketamine's effectiveness against depression. She changed her mind, however, when she saw it work. The first person I treated, I was just astounded, she says. The speed of powerful effects was unlike any treatment I've ever seen for depression. Pooled data from three separate studies support Liu's experience. Two-thirds of the people with the treatment-resistant diagnosis improved in ketamine infusions. Again, even that's not really a fantastic amount. The drawback of ketamine is that while hallucinations are reminiscent of classical psychedelics, effects don't last with people and become desensitized over time. Quote, just because one dose works for a few days doesn't mean that giving 5 or 10 doses is going to lead to a long-term benefit, Liu says. She and her team are conducting a trial of 200 people with depression, the largest of its kind so far, to see if repeat dosing of ketamine is safe and leads to lasting remission. So that's another really interesting aspect. So this is our next article. We're 24 minutes in, and I'm going to read it. It's Spectrum, People, Culture and News. Lily Cerner, a division bell. So this is Zygus. This seems to be a series of sections various people. So Zygus is sort of, I don't know, it's a comet, but associated with people. Okay, now see who's the author of this. Michael Lucy is a features editor of Cosmos. Lisa Sarah was just 5 years old when she was driving around the city of Jerusalem with her grandfather. She first ran headlong into infinity. With the old man assisting, she practiced her counting. We reached all the way up to 100, and I could not imagine the big numbers she crawls. He told me no matter what number I could think of, there was always a number bigger, including the actual number of numbers. If you add that to the numbers, you get a trans-infinite number. Young Serena was perplexed. She the seed had been sown. It would grow into a passion and lead to her unusual career that spans the realm of mathematics and television. With a head for figures, she gathered cult following to compare the geeky game show called Letters and Numbers. In that world of maths entertainment, quite a narrow field, she acknowledges, Serena became a superstar. She was 8 and her parents moved the family from Jerusalem to Sydney to secure a better education for her and her brother. Quote, education is very important to them, she says, and that too took root. After high school, she combined abstract and worldly interests by pursuing maths, finance and international studies at the University of Technology, Sydney. A year spent studying in France. After completing a double degree, she decided to continue on with an honours year in maths. And it was in the middle of that I fell into TV. The fall began at the maths camp at La Trobe University in Melbourne, where Serena met someone who, in connection with Australia's special broadcasting service, SBS, it transpired, was looking for a woman with pro-level maths to co-host a brain-teasing game show. I didn't have a job at the time, so I thought it might well go for it. I said to my mum, imagine if I got this. And we both burst out laughing because it was the most unimaginable thing. Get the job Serena did. Letters and Numbers was based on a pair of long-running French and British programs in which the contestants competed against in-house experts in games of arithmetic and wordplay. The show was hosted by veteran newsreader Richard Moorcroft. In the two expert sidekicks were Letters, handled by crossword guru David Asti, and Numbers by Serena. The oddball charm of the unashamed nerdity helps Letters and Numbers become a cult hit. Sarah herself played no small part in the success. She dazzled the audience with her winning smile and arithmetical acumen and began to acquire a loyal following of her own. Although Letters and Numbers only ran in 2010 to 2012, the reruns are still on there today. My career then split in two, she says. I've been on both paths ever since. Despite a hectic filming schedule, shooting 450 half-hour episodes over 2 years, Serena continued her studies part-time. She won a scholarship to work at an honours project with CSIRO that applied fluid dynamics to marine biology, modelling and movement of pollution in the water around Queensland's Great Barrier Reef. Unsurprisingly, she received top marks. Serena's twin path took her into environmental consulting and touring Australia with fellow part-time TV personalities Adam Lua, former lawyer turned chef, and Rene Lim, a doctor, to film the combination of food travel show Destination Flavour. In early 2016, Serena got a tip from her brother who was working as an engineering manager for the fast-growing software company Atlassian, about a job going for someone with her skills. Atlassian, which in 15 years has gone from a garage startup to a multi-billion dollar behemoth, makes software for use by other companies, mainly for managing projects and helping them team collaborate. Serena's job is to use data to help understand and improve the customer experience. Companies generate so much data, she says. I have all these mathematical techniques and methods that I apply to data to get a picture of what's going on. Technically, there's a whole host of things I do. Hypothesis testing, machine learning, predictive modeling, cluster analysis, and the buzzword of this type of work for data science, but I basically do maths. These are buzzwords. It is, quote, a very fun company to work for, according to Serena. They've got lots of bright people around to learn from. In addition to the day jobs, one of Serena's aims is to be a role model for women working in maths, where they have historically been underrepresented. I must admit, I perhaps am in the wrong milieu. Okay. Quote, there are two facts that we have in front of us, she says, laying out the case. One, we know women generally have lower confidence in their maths ability. Two, there have been any number of tests to show that on average there is no difference between men and women in mathematical aptitude. That is what we have to work with. Historically, women are effectively discouraged from doing maths and science. That kind of discrimination has a real long-term effect. Although things are improving, it takes a while for that kind of things to filter out. Now, this is also interesting in terms of, like, I want to do science teaching, and I'm, as a scientist, been discouraged from doing it. So that's a good point. Serena's personal experience have been largely positive. Quote, I won't say I've ever come across discrimination because I have had generally believed that 99% of the people don't discriminate. I did have a healthy dose of defiance and a charge on attitude. It's not something I've ever thought was going to stop me. Serena will appear in an episode of ABC science documentary show Catalyst, airing in 2018, though the details are still under wraps, where she's allowed to say about it, how can we use math to make rigorous decisions? Despite her already having two highly successful careers, Serena is also like to spread out to other areas. Quote, I'd love to set up some kind of not-for-profit that helps kids and maths homework. A lot of studies show that kids who get help and have mentors early on are more likely to enjoy maths. And puzzles, she adds, as an afterthought. People like puzzles. I do like to do something else with puzzles. She's published a book, Lily's Number Puzzles, in 2012. My problem is that I have too many ideas. I need to concentrate a few. It's just like numbers. No matter what you think of, there's always something bigger. And that's it's a story of podcasting, getting the podcast machines and social machines behind it. Zygist, another person on a person. And 31 minutes, so I'm trying to go for 40 minutes here. The artist, his lab, is his semi-living work, and this is written by Andrew Masterson, a news editor for Cosmos. Okay, throughout October this year in Western Australia, in the city of Perth, will demonstrate a faintly disturbing obsession with Frankenstein. The city will mark the 200th anniversary of Mary Shelley's novel being first published anonymously in London, with the events that included the international conference, several exhibitions and other activities. It might seem odd that the biggest commemoration of literary landmark is taking place in a small city on the other side of the world. It all starts to make sense, however, when you learn the identity of one of the principal organisers, Oran Katz. Born in Finland and resident of Perth since the past 20 years, he's pretty much the closest analogue to Dr. Frankenstein you can find outside this side of fiction. Operating at the intersection of art and science, Katz is the director of Symbotica, a laboratory that explores aesthetic and philosophical dimensions of tissue culture based on the School of Anatomy at the University of Western Australia. Wow. During his tenure, Katz has enjoyed roles as research fellow at Harvard Medical School's Tissue Engineering and Organ Fabrication Laboratory, a gig at Stanford University Department of Art and Design Professorship at London's Royal College of Art. Mostly, however, he is known for two things, making creepy bits of art, usually living cells, and playing a big hand in inventing lab-grown meat. Mostly, however, he is known for two things, making really creepy bits of art using living cells and playing... In 2003, he and a long-time collaborator, Arnott Zur, grew the world's first, quote, semi-living steak from focus cells. It was eventually marinated in apple brandy and fried up in garlic and honey and served. It tasted awful, but it wasn't the point. Quote, for me, growing meat in the lab was never about trying to solve the problem of meat production, but rather to highlight the strangeness of our relationship to other life forms, Kat says. Consuming another biological being is incorporating in it part of your own biological body can be seen as the most intimate relationship you can have with another life form. So what does it mean to eat meat that has no body? Quite surprisingly or not, this type of question resulted in the fact that Anna and I were growing meat in the lab more than a decade before it became hype techno fix that presents itself now. Their work, the later very public events featuring the celebrity Heston Blumenfeld, prompted intense interest and potential of lab-grown meat as a cruelty-free solution to the cultural and environmental problems of livestock farming. Katz always disagreed, once dismissing the growing of in-vitro flesh as nothing more than expensive exercise and rearranging proteins. What a great person. Quote, I see the current fascination with lab-grown meat, the wider field of cellular agriculture as a symptom of our current times, such as hyper-consumerism, an innovation paradigm, and a prevailing engineering mindset, quote, he says. The problem that lab-grown meat is attempting to solve can be addressed much more easily by behavioural change such as reduced consumption. But this solution does not represent a business model worth investing in. The meat project was arguably an exercise in science, histology at least, shackled to the services of art. Its interpretation by public skewed slightly by perceived promise of utility. No such promise has been apprehended to some of Katz's other endeavours, which make them all the more fun. There's the victimless leather project, for instance, in which he and colleagues grew an entire leather jacket made from cultured cells on a polymer substrate. If it's cruel to kill an animal to make a garment and from its hide, how do we feel about a garment that is quasi-alive? The pigskin project in 2001 utilized porcelain stem cells to create and grow bone tissue in the shape of wings. The results are now in New York's Museum of Modern Art. And then there's the semi-living warring dolls. These were a set of seven small humanoid figures constructed from degradable polymers seeded with skin, muscles and bone cells. The dolls fleshed out and deformed by their own living tissues, each a little bottle of nourishing medium having exhibited in the museums around the world. For all the combination of laboratory techniques, stem cell research and visual impact in his work, Katz resists any suggestion of common ground between arts and science. It's an argument he finds suspicious and possibly malignant. This is actually quite sophisticated, isn't it? Art and science are very different fields of human endeavour, he says. They are complementary at times and oppositional at others. Artists using the same technological tools as scientists are not doing science, and scientists who are producing images are not doing art. In my lab, I talk about the integrity of disciplines, and this is really interesting about the transdisciplinary approach. And that's really interesting. There's sort of, you've got the transdisciplinary people who go in, and the people who have been transdisciplinary getting a more mature view. So almost that transdisciplinary studies have a path of maturation. In my lab, I talk about, there is growing confusion already between science and engineering. Many engineers claim to be scientists, so throwing art into the mix might confuse things further. It sometimes seems that co-opting art into the mix as part of a larger project is attempting to silence and diffuse critical thinking and might harm the business as usual mindset. The site being represented in collections around the world, Katz's work is biologically, therefore, inherently time-limited. Biological tissues rot, and since he isn't concerned with it in the least with his art, will eventually turn to dust or slime. He recounts a recent collaboration between a Japanese artist and scientist working at Hado Iwasaki, an expert in cyanobacteria. Working in a remote pillar region in Africa, in Western Australia, the pair collaborated on a project looking for the idea of time as an instrument of humility. When you think about the deep time, the geological time frames, the question of art lasting becomes completely irrelevant, he says. Very little, if any, of human intentional activity would remain. All we do is transient. Mary Shelley, if not Frankenstein himself, would surely have approved. 38 minutes, okay. Shit. This is in Spectrum, Smoke and Mirrors. Jason England is a magician based in Las Vegas, renowned for authority on casino gambling and card handling. And this is his own article. Okay. Strange how these gets in here. The origin of the game blackjack or 21 is unclear. Game historians can trace the early version called to the late 16th century. A brilliant Spanish novelist, Miguel de Cervantes, references cheating in the game in a comical history of Rinette and Cortando, published in 1570. In the century since, at least one thing has remained essentially unchanged. People are still trying to figure out ways to beat the game. Okay, so it's already Vingt-et-un rather than Trente-et-un. Okay. Because that's... Yep. They've actually written... Oh well, this may be the way it's said. The modern game is fairly simple. The object is to beat the dealer and getting a total close to 21 as possible without going over. In the standard version, the dealer deals two cards and each player has, as well as themselves. The player's card can be dealt either face up or face down, but the dealer always takes one exposed up card and a hidden hole card. The player makes a decision based on both the value of their own cards and the dealer's up card. This includes whether to hit, draw an additional card, and when to stand, take no more cards. The value of the dealer's hole card is hidden through the play. If the player knows its value, it would have a significant advantage. In the late 1980s, a team of Las Vegas-based players managed to develop a hidden, wearable blackjack computer called Captain Crunch to enable to determine the dealer's hole card. The algorithm built in the computer took advantage of the decades-old procedure from an old card trick. The result is still... was then signaled to another player on the table. The method was nothing short of ingenious. Take the deck of cards and remove an entire suit. The hearts will do nicely. Put all that hearts into a numerical sequence, begin with the ace and ending with the king. Then remove the entire suit of clubs and place them in order. Now take two suits and execute the casino-style riffle shuffle. Shuffle them together. The casual hand shuffle will not work. The method depends on the casino shuffle to function properly. Only perform a single shuffle. Once you've shuffled the two suits together, turn the combined pack face up and spread the cards on the table, being careful not to disturb the position. Examine the sequence and you'll notice that you've shuffled two suits together, the individual sequences are present and spread. You'll either have a H, H or AC as the top card. Oh, so ace. I don't know what C stands for. Oh, hearts, clubs, ace, club, followed by the rest of the cards, either king hearts or king clubs as the bottom cards. The 2H will come after the AH, and depending on your shuffle, the two cards may have some clubs shuffled in between them. Regardless, you should be able to see the sequence of hearts and clubs clearly. What does this mean? In a single shuffle, does a poor job of mixing playing cards, performing two shuffles isn't much better. Captain Crunch took advantage of this by calculating from the cards dealt any missing cards. Here's how. Pick up your shuffled pack and cut the cards anywhere you like. Complete the cut. Place the top deck aside without looking at it. This will represent the dealer's hole card. Now cut the combined pack again. Begin turning over the cards to the same top packet at one time. Place them aside as you do. Depending on your cut of the packet, a typical sequence may look like 5H, 6H, 5C, 6C, 7C, 7H, 8C, 9H, 9C, 10H. Notice anything strange? Although it's only a small portion of the cards, you can readily tell the sequence is missing an 8H. Where is it? The card, as you set aside earlier. Using virtually the exact procedure, Captain Crunch was able to positively determine the dealer's hole card to roughly 65% of the time. The player wearing the computer had to input every card suit as value in the computer using a hidden toe switch. The algorithm depended on weak shuffling procedures using only a few riffle shuffles. Shuffling procedures are more secure now, but using only a small number of shuffles, it was common in the 1980s. As the hands were dealt with the play, Crunch was told what the cards were in the player's hand and hit the cards were. With a few cards, the computer was usually able to determine the hole card. As the player wearing the computer then secretly signaled to the last player at the table, this player would begin with to bet large sums and typically be the only player to benefit the hole card information. The other players, including the one operating Captain Crunch, bet the table minimum. While we determined our missing card by examining two different suits, Crunch was able to work out for any cards regardless of the suit and value by grouping them in threes. The method won an absolute fortune for developers and was never discovered by casinos. Eventually though, stronger shuffling procedures brought an end to success. Isn't that amazing? Okay, 44 minutes. Thanks a lot. And hopefully I'll get through this magazine. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.